Hey folks, my name is Tim. Welcome to The Table, the podcast edition. The Table is a community that exists to make room to explore what we believe. What you're about to hear is the podcast edit of something that we do together in person. We just call it the Talky Bit. We're sharing it with you in the hope that it can be a positive contribution and a catalyst for your own exploration, or perhaps something that you share with somebody else you know is exploring what they believe to support and encourage them. In our experience, exploring what you believe can be hard work, exciting, encouraging, but also challenging. And we don't think that anyone should have to do that alone. On a perhaps more personal note, I don't believe that we do it best alone. I think we do it best together with others. We're able to do this work because of the generous support of donors both within and beyond the local community. If you want to contribute to keeping it going, you can find information about how to do that at thetablewinnipeg.com under the Giving tab. Thanks for dropping by. Welcome to the Talky Bit. It's been a while since we've had something in our gathering that would feel like what I wrote in my notes was like a normal Talky Bit, because we've been spending a few weeks looking back over the past year. We've been asking ourselves both what went well and what we think we could do better. And from my perspective, that's been time well spent. It's been an informative and, from my perspective, an encouraging exercise. I'll put a summary document of some of that feedback together, and I'll make that available to everyone who's interested at some point over the next couple of weeks. There'll just be a link, and you can go see the summary if you wish. I've been heartened to hear from people in the community how our reason for being, which is to make room to explore what we believe, has served them well. And I'm not mentioning this arbitrarily or just to pump our own tires, although I think mentioning it and pumping our own tires can be a good thing to do. Having grown up in an environment where my mother had this, you know, folk saying about not spraining your arm, patting yourself on the back, I also think it's really important to affirm ourselves individually and collectively when things are going well. It's very important to pause to attend to what's good. It's not sticky for our brains. What's sticky for our brains is what is difficult, what's troubling, what's distressing, what feels like danger. And so to remember the things that are good requires a deliberate effort. And I feel like we've done that over the last few weeks, about the past year, as well as looking ahead and going, how could we do this thing that we believe in better? And the connection, I said it also wasn't an arbitrary mention. All that aside, I'm mentioning that exploration partly because we're about to dive into an exploration of the horrendous damage that can be done by systems, and in particular religious systems that disallow exploration of belief. Something a good number of us have encountered in various forms and in degrees over our lives, and something that we can readily observe in action even if it isn't our lived experience. It's not very hard to find these systems in the world. I want to offer a bit of a disclaimer in the early going. In fact, I suspect that a fair bit of the early going might feel like it's littered with disclaimers. I think that'll become clear enough why that's the case as we go. I won't say more about it now. I'll just carry on. But at this point, I wouldn't be surprised if this exploration triggers things for some of us. And I'm using the word technically there as well as colloquially. I don't say that blithely. I am not proceeding without being aware that that could be an extremely unpleasant experience to have. I could pick other adjectives, but I'll stick with unpleasant for now. That said, I also believe that putting a name to what we or what people we know have experienced is often an essential step in a healing journey. And so I want to offer these explorations in the hope of that being the case. In terms of our shared space for this, at its core, it's what it always is, or at least always aspires to be, a place where the norm is that you can stay or go or move around or do what you need to do to listen or participate or not. In short, do what you know or even suspect will serve you best in terms of being present and being assured or reassured that this is a space that is committed to being as safe as possible. We cannot make a space safe, categorically. But we can make it safer. And I hope some of those things can help make it safer. All right.
What is it that we're setting off to explore that qualifies for all this preamble? Well, the big umbrella is, in terms of language, the big umbrella term for what we're wading into is religious trauma. A relatively new category, if you will, for those of you who are aware of or who would defer to this particular modality. It's not in the DSM as a diagnosis. It is in the DSM as an attendant syndrome, so formally recognized within those disciplines. But even the terminology is a clue, and I think maybe a little more amenable entry point, religious trauma. So we already know, just from the language, that we've got a two-part invention here, religion and trauma. And both of those could use some defining. We'll get to that in due course. But what I wanted to start with this morning was an image. Now, if you are generally curious or you're listening on the podcast and can't see the picture, this is a picture of an intersection in Japan called the Takayo-san Interchange. That's roads, in case it wasn't obvious. And it's part of a larger system that will eventually form a ring road all the way around Tokyo. I got this photo from a structural engineering site that had a whole bunch of photographs of complex interchanges on it. And on that site, this photograph felt like a, woo, would you look at that beauty of an interchange? Like, it was kind of like a, oh, man. You know, so I guess if you're a structural engineer, that's how that might feel.
If I'm driving, no.
That, you know, you're one jump ahead of me, Andreas, because what I said next in my notes is, as someone who's driven in some other countries, not in this one, but I can tell you by experience that what looks like woohoo in an aerial drone shot can look like, oh, crap, in person. That sensation of I'll never get out of here alive or I'm trapped in an endless loop is deeply unpleasant at best, and it only gets worse when there's something running in the background like, and my plane is leaving soon, you know, cranking up the pressure. So as we start exploring this complicated maze of ideas, some of us might be intrigued or curious, eager to go exploring, and others of us might really feel like somebody is just, like we're just waiting for someone to toss our world off a cliff. We're not feeling woohoo at all about this idea, and many things in between. But there are a couple of other potential takeaways from this image. One is the reminder that what we're going to be exploring is tremendously complex. It's got all sorts of layers and twists and turns. That said, this exploration is also intended to provide us with some ways to navigate, to get where we wish or need to go. And there are many different, I don't want to press the metaphor till it breaks, but I'm going to press it a little further. There are many different entry points, and they're all relevant to the whole, but they're not all accessible at once, and they're not all equally applicable to each of us, depending on what our starting point or starting points might be. So what I'm going to do today, and I'll do this sort of throughout the series, I think, but I'm going to pick one entry point, and I promise you I did do some agonizing about where to begin, and I'm going to get underway. This won't be everyone's preferred starting point, I realize. What I'm going to do is I'm going to start in a place that we almost never do here. I'm going to start with a verse from the Bible. And yes, I know that this might be enough to send some of us running from the room. And if we think of possible responses as being on a continuum, at the other end of that continuum, it might provide some folks with a sense of, oh, good, that's reassuring, and lots of other points in between. I will eventually expand on and explain this choice, so just stay with me here. To clarify at least one, what I think is important matter, I'm not putting this text up as representing any kind of authority or any kind of big T truth. Right? This is not coming up on the screen so I can point to it and say this is what God says, and you should take it in that light. It's a collection of ideas from a library that documents a long history of people trying to find a story that helps them understand and navigate the world, a process that I believe is ongoing for humanity. That'd be how I would regard the status of this text. Here you go. This is from 1 Corinthians 6th chapter, 19th and 20th verses, for those familiar with that way of finding your way around the library. Do you not know that your bodies are the temples of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom you have received from God? You are not your own. You were bought with a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. All right. So, it's important in the context of this exploration to know that the emphasis in the context of this exploration is on the phrase, you are not your own, and that this applies to your body. Your body's not your own. That's what it says here. It doesn't belong to you, according to this piece of text. It belongs to God, because God paid for it. That's what it says. We can stop right there and talk about the problems that arise from the profoundly dehumanizing and transactional nature of those ideas, but we are headed somewhere else. Where we need to go first, I think, is to articulating some of the different perspectives on what verse from the Bible even means, which I've touched on, but I want to go a little further into that, because that's a key piece of why the same verse, this one, for example, can be read in so many different ways, and why some ways of reading it or teaching other people what it means and how it should be applied are much more likely to produce an environment where religious trauma is probable than would otherwise be the case. So the way I just talked about it, body's not yours, belongs to God because God paid for it, that's a frame for that verse that's much more likely to provide the context for trauma than if I said, what this verse is really talking about is how we move through the world as embodied beings. Are we doing good with our bodies, or aren't we, in the world? Because we could take such an idea from such a text as well, right? When it comes to, and this is going to be a little bit of a quick journey through some history here, near history, so do not be afraid. When it comes to religious trauma, there's a subset of Christianity that almost ideally creates the conditions for it to happen, and there are discernible reasons why that is the case and how that subset got there. That subset is most broadly called evangelicalism or evangelical Christianity. Those are the big terms that get used for that subset. This particular sect of Christian belief and beliefs is not the whole story about what people who identify as Christians believe. But it's a big, influential part of the story, especially on this continent, and especially over the past couple of hundred years on this continent. Now, just so we know what we are and are not talking about when we use those terms, evangelicalism and evangelical Christianity, in this context, what I want to do is try to sum up the central tenets of this belief system as I'll be referring to it. Okay, so this is what I'm referring to when I use those terms over the next few weeks. And I'm going to do that so that we have some shared understanding for what we're exploring. There are lots of parts of this summary that will be debatable. There's many where, at least in some circles, the debate is a hot one to this very day. I'm not going to focus on those points of debate for several reasons, not the least of which is that I don't feel any personal call to defend this system, and also that our context doesn't require its defense. That's not the space we're in. Broadly speaking, evangelical Christians in the Western world believe in a few key tenets. And among those are the historical accuracy and the literal interpretation of both the Hebrew Bible, what we might commonly have grown up calling the Old Testament or First Testament, and the New Testament. In other words, from that perspective, everything in the collection, all the stories, all the words, actually literally happened in the Western sense of history. The words, as we have them, are literal descriptions of literal happenings. So that's what that perspective believes. So if the text says that a snake talked or a donkey talked, that means they opened their mouths and articulated speech came out, and so on, right? A particular note in this belief system is that that approach includes the divinity, the godness, if you will, the death, during the resurrection of Jesus the Christ, and the belief in the necessity of personal conversion, the necessity of being born again as a condition for salvation. So these are all like baseline tenets of this belief system. And the underpinning of that belief, the necessity of being born again as a condition for salvation, is the notion that conversion and salvation are necessary because of the existence of a place of eternal conscious torment called hell that all people in their natural state are deserving of, because they were born into a nature of inherited sin. So these are baseline beliefs in this system, all right? We just did a whole series on hell. So for anybody who wants a little more nuanced exploration of that particular item, it's in the podcast archive. Little pause button. If you feel like you're having trouble breathing right now, or like your heart rate is elevated, or your skin feels warm, or. I'm not here to tell you how to respond to that, but I would be willing to suggest that we're probably exploring something that's pretty relevant to you. I don't want to get too deep into the historical weeds on this, but it's worth noting that evangelical Christianity arrived at this point, this particular coalescence of fundamentals in early in the 21st century because of developments, and this is pretty fascinating to me, that are tied directly to the American Civil War. Evangelical Christianity didn't just fall out of the sky as a belief system, and it definitely wasn't delivered to humans by the divine. It has a very understandable, very human context. Before that conflict, the American Civil War, Christian denominations historians often called that whole sort of related belief system Northern Evangelicalism, as in Northern U.S. And that group of beliefs made a real connection between moralism and social justice. In other words, Northern Evangelicalism was this branch of Christianity that advocated for things like temperance, humane treatment of the mentally disabled, prison reform. But as a group, one of their most militant positions was that slavery should be abolished. They believed that it was morally wrong. They believed that it was socially destructive, to pick a couple of high points. And it's almost hard to believe from a contemporary perspective, but this institutional bastion of conservatism that is Wheaton College in the U.S. was founded by abolitionist evangelicals in the 1850s. And it was an institution that welcomed both African-American and female students and served as a stop on the Underground Railway. But, and this is a big piece of the religious entry point in this conversation, as the progressive part of that movement continued to seek to find common ground between science, faith, and what is known as New Criticism. Basically, New Criticism was a movement that came to sacred text, to Scripture, and said, what happens to this story if we just take all the things that we call miraculous out of it? How does this story read if we don't literally read the miracles, like talking snakes and donkeys? So there's this movement, and Northern Evangelicals were like, what's the common ground here? Like, how can these things talk to one another in a productive and helpful way? Pretty interesting, right? So that's what's going on with Northern Evangelicalism. And the conservatives in the House took offense with that progression, and they tried to rein things in. So institutionally, what they tried to do was fire the progressives, so to speak. Woodrow Wilson's, I think, uncle lost his job at Wheaton. Anyway, like, there's all these stories that are inside of this about, you know, famous Americans and their relationship to this. That didn't really work, the fire the progressives thing, but they sure tried. And then, also as part of this reaction, they published a series of books called The Fundamentals, hence the term fundamentalists applied to this movement. And they focused on a simplistic and overly literal reading of the Bible. They reacted against evolution to the point of just saying all science is immoral and bad and can't be trusted, and against the so-called social gospel, this idea that if we actually want to follow a God who is good, then we should also do good in the world. And they reacted against that to a degree that characterized the whole concept of social justice as just this dangerous liberal idea. Like, that whole category is just bad news, stay clear, or you're going to be going down the slippery slope to hell. And I can hear that. This is what was really intriguing to me when I was studying this, because it's like I can hear the echoes of this in my own thinking anytime I'm inclined to be dismissive about, pick a category, but what I put in my notes was an unhoused person's dilemma, by thinking something like, you know, they'd be fine if they just got a job. That's the extension of this, of what I'm describing, right? Like, that's the embodied echo of those paths of thinking. And some scholars call this period the Great Reversal. The idea being that much of the good that might be carried by the Christian narrative got lost in this dilemma. And out of this come movements like the religious right in the last half of the 20th century, and that's followed by movements like the moral majority, and by movements that have an obsession with obtaining and securing a position of dominant political power. Well, now this is starting to sound rather contemporary, isn't it? So Jerry Falwell, well-known figure in those movements, announced that securing a position of dominant political power for those ideological positions was a done deal in September of 2018. He wrote this: our goal has been achieved. The religious right is solidly in place, and religious conservative values in America are now in for the duration. Close quote. To make a long story short, and if you really want, I can happily refer you to the scholarly works that are running in the background of this very broad brush summary. The disagreement over whether slavery was Christian or not gave rise to the Southern Baptists, who are still the second largest Christian denomination in the world after Catholicism, and the group of which 81% voted for the current president of the U.S. The relationship between these ideas and the holding of power ideologically is not very hard to see historically. It's kind of in plain view. They historically wanted power, and from that vantage point, they got it. One of the upshots of that is that many of the values of this branch of religion have infiltrated the arena of Western society as a whole. To quote from one of the historians whose work is focused on this movement, quote, "These doctrinal messages are woven into the fabric of society and encoded in secular legislation such as laws regarding sexuality and reproduction," close quote. Body laws. Remember? Your body's not yours. It doesn't belong to you, according to the text. Read it literally. Read it from the perspective of the folks who are after these things. And regardless of what we think of Law X about bodies, the thing that we're noting here is that a particular branch of a specific religion has held enough sway in near history on this continent to have its values enshrined in law. And many of those values have directly to do with how we think about our bodies. And the reason I keep coming back to bodies is because when we talk about what trauma is and how it works, we'll be talking about our bodies, because that's where trauma resides. So we've got this whole value set that has to do with, among other things, our bodies. And it comes from a particular religious movement's perspective. Hence all the body emphasis. It's not arbitrary. And my hope is that when we sort of take the on-ramp in our you know, complex options of on-ramps here, when we take the on-ramp of exploring what trauma is, how it happens and where it resides, this will come a little clearer. But since we can't talk about all the aspects of this at once, I'm going to invite us to more or less set that piece to the side for now, having noted it. We will get there. And as we'll see when we move into that entry point of what the same branch of religion teaches about authority and who has the last word about our bodies, the underpinning of traumas are already in place. Because if my body's not mine, whose is it? And who gets to tell me what I can and can't do with it? And why? So now we're into religious authority structures telling me how I can live and how I can't. What's okay and what's not. What's valuable and what's not. As you might be able to imagine, or you might have lived experience with, the sexual and political revolutions of the 50s and 60s pushed back on some of this, led to a further reactionary movement, and leaders in that movement vehemently opposed what they targeted as the evils of society. And there were some really particular targets for them: racially integrated schools, comprehensive sex education, abortion, homosexuality — that was the dominant language of the time — and the influence of big government. Those were some of their biggies. And they were adamant about nationalism and their belief that America had previously been a Christian nation before the liberals got a hold of it, from their perspective, which also historically meant, so when it was Christian, it was also racially segregated. Those things were intrinsically connected for this movement. But what really got that movement fired up was when the government attempted to desegregate evangelical colleges. They were like, now it's personal, right? And the threat of them losing their tax-exempt status if they didn't desegregate was infuriating, and the result was this public outcry against this big outcry against public education in particular, and what was often called the secular world in general. And lots of those leaders built multi-billion-dollar industries around these messages and wielded an incredible amount of cultural influence. Anybody who grew up around the massive empire, the figurehead of which was James Dobson, focus on the family. A high-profile example of this. Now, this might strike some of us as unfortunate shorthand for something that is tremendously complex. So perhaps think of this next idea as a handle on something that's too big to readily get our arms around. Once again, both potentially helpful and potentially dangerous. Like, it could be too simple, right? So this thing can be careful with. If we want a clue to watch for when we're scanning our own histories or history in general for warning signs that we might be bumping up against this sort of system, and this isn't exclusive to Christianity or even to religion, one thing to watch for is the language of the binary. If we bump into a system that says that everything is either black or white, and there's little tolerance for nuance or recognition of personal preference or agency within that system, we should pay attention. Perhaps we could say that we should wrestle not to fall into black and white thinking about black and white thinking. And yes, that is complex to the point of being confounding, I think, especially for minds that have been trained to think in either-or terms much of our life, which there's a reason why that way of thinking is has as much sway in this culture at this time as it does, and we've just been talking about some of the reasons why. They don't come from nowhere. There are many places in the world where we could go, billions of people for whom what I suggested would feel readily accessible, not at all troubling, not difficult, both and thinking. Fine. We live in a both and universe, don't we? So, of course. But for many of us, that's not the case. And that in itself should be instructive if what we're reflecting on is the danger of absolutizing ideas. Those things are connected. One last thought on this, and then we're going to leave it for today, at least as far as what I'm offering for us to muse about. For my part, and I know this is true for others in the community as well, I know folks who still identify as Christian and evangelical who can clearly acknowledge these dangers and yet find themselves able to stay in the movement. Some of those people, some of whom I have a fair bit of influence in that and whom I know, some of them strike me as being a little bit like the mythological Old Testament prophets. There's this lonely voices crying in the wilderness saying, this is not okay. This is not morally right. This is not socially helpful. And even, this is not what Jesus would do. I haven't seen that wristband yet. This is not what Jesus would do, but maybe it would be helpful, even if it's a bit of a long acronym. I'd wear that wristband. I'd wear that t-shirt. And that reminds me to at least try, personally, to take care of my own thinking, to not fall into the binary, while also being as unflinching as I am able about the dangers that are inherent in many of these belief systems, not the least of the dangers of which is the creation of ideal conditions for trauma, which we will explore another day. Is it odd to be in this terrain and to wish us peace at the end? To me, it feels both odd and needful. And that's because I believe that peace is something we work for. It's not something that falls out of the sky into our laps. And so, in that spirit, peace, let's keep on exploring what we believe.